I can't say how pleased I am to be able to present to you tonight Professor William McDonald. And the first thing I should say is that there are professors and then there are professors. There are professors by rank and by appointment, and there there's a much smaller group of people who are professors by attitude, by their life. Professor McDonald has been out of the official academic world for a number of years, though he's put in his time, as you'll see in a few minutes. He's now what we would come to what we would know as a freelancer, and with all of those wonderful romantic associations of freelancers, we think of khaki coats and pith helmets of Ernest Hemingway and sports cars with the tops down, things like that. Professor McDonald has made the choice to become a full-time art historian without the crutch, as it were, of an academic appointment. He left academia to devote himself completely to the study of art history. He's one of the few people who's had the gumption to do that. And I think it has come out very clearly in his research and his publications. Now, I said he has put in his time in academia. He's done his bit. He's been to the right places and done the right sort of things. He got his degrees, all three of his degrees, from Harvard. After that, he was a fellow at the American Academy in Rome. After that, coming back to this country, he was a professor first at Yale University for a number of years, then moved to Smith College in Massachusetts. He's been, in the meantime, visiting professors at such illustrious places at Harvard, MIT, Berkeley, soon to be at Georgetown, etc. He's most recently, in 1985 and 86, he's been a visiting scholar at the Getty Center for Fine Arts in Santa Monica, California, one of the great new spots in the art historical world. His publications are numerous, and I think probably a lot of you are familiar with them, whether you know it or not. His early book on early Christian and Byzantine art, which was published in the George Brasler series in the History of Architecture, is one that many, many people have looked at over the years. He's written on a three-volume, or is in the process of working on a three-volume set of books on the architecture of the Roman Empire, the first volume, and was published several years ago. The second volume has just come out, and the third volume is in preparation. He's written books on the Pantheon design, meaning, and progeny, booklets on Piranesi's Carceri. Those of you who know Piranesi, a tremendously innovative and interesting 18th century Italian graphic artist. While he was at Smith College, he did work on the architecture and buildings of Northampton, Massachusetts. He's been the associate editor of the Princeton Encyclopedia of Classical Sites. And to show you that freelancers don't just sit back and enjoy gin and tonics with their pith helmets, his recent work has included articles on specific areas of Hadrian's Villa in the Journal of the Society of Architectural Historians, a contribution to a book in tribute of Henry Russell Hitchcock, one of the great American architectural historians, with the fascinating title of Excavation, Restoration, and Italian Architecture of the 1930s. He's written recently, in the last year or so, on empire imagery in Augustan architecture and on connection and passage in North African architecture. He's preparing a book on Hadrian's Great Villa at Tivoli, which, by the way, is going to be the subject of another talk that he's giving tomorrow afternoon here at the Rhodes campus. So I think altogether we're very fortunate to have Professor McDonald with us tonight. And we're also very fortunate, very lucky, to have him address the topic, which is of fundamental, if not perhaps of immediately obvious importance, which when he speaks on the durability of classical architecture. Professor McDonald.
Thank you very much, Professor Russell, for that introduction. And thank you for asking me to come here to Rhodes College to speak tonight and tomorrow. It's an honor to be here on the Moss Foundation, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to make this first visit. Not my first visit to Memphis or by any means to Tennessee, but to this campus. I appreciate it a great deal. I only want to make two suggestions to you. One is that classicism in architecture, which ought to have died any number of times, late antiquity, end of the Renaissance, Counter-Reformation, neoclassicism, Beaux-Arts, modernism, has not died. I bring that news. And second, what on earth are the reasons for this? By all rational historical principle, it should not have been resuscitated repeatedly, not just in the Western world alone, but wherever Western people have gone. And for better or worse, however we may feel about classical architecture, it's still with us. And I'd like to offer two fundamental suggestions about it. One, that in antiquity, the great white temple on the hill was not the important thing in classical architecture, but that classical architecture was very popular, daily, quotidian sort of thing. And second, make some suggestions to you why I think it has persisted, been so durable, and been a wellspring of architectural thinking and design, influenced the other arts, of course, as well. May we have the lights down, please? If you open the standard textbook of Greek and Roman architecture, you quickly run into this kind of diagram. Underneath it says, very helpfully, plan of Roman temple. If you look at it for a little bit, you'll realize it's not very informative. It isn't really a plan. It shows two or three levels at the same time. It requires a certain knowledge, not expertise, but a certain knowledge to know how to read such things. And after a while, as the instructor or instructress talks, you realize that it has a flight of steps on the left, some freestanding columns, which those round black disks represent on the left, and that it has a large enclosed hall with a single doorway. This kind of plan, this kind of illustration, pervades, and understandably so, the general histories of classical architecture and histories of architecture in the Western world. For example, the Corinthian order, which we're all familiar with. You really can't get away from it in the United States, except in some of the built new towns of this century. The impression is given in such textbooks and handbooks, and as once again I say quite understandably, that to build a great temple and to decorate it with these celebrated forms which are so familiar we think we know about them is the essence of classicism. And I would say tonight to us, perhaps, but not necessarily so. In all the how-to books about classicism, and the first one was published in 1540, these suites of orders, that is to say, the famous Doric, Ionic, Corinthian, etc., are shown in this fashion. This plate is taken from a London publication of the middle of the 18th century, but it will stand for not just scores, but hundreds of such. The sort of thing that lies behind so much of classical repetition, almost wherever one travels in the Western world and in the westernized parts of the rest of the world. These are very peculiar drawings. They're intended to show the master builder or carpenter or architect what the correct proportions and ratios are of height, width, details of moldings and the like, as I'm sure you know. But if you look at them closely, and the bottom part of the plate is missing in my slide, you see that they're perched precariously on pedestals, that they have little chunks of that horizontal element of classicism called the entablature up above. The far left one really ought to fall off there. And they're not, of course, architecture at all. They're diagrams to assist the builder of a beautiful Southern antebellum mansion or a New England church front or some such thing as that. But it was on a printed page, and one of the questions in front of us has to be, why did those things come about? How did the translation take place between the real thing? Here we are about AD 10 in Nîmes in Provence in southern France, and how do we get from there to 1700 years later as in the Suite of Orders from this English publication? There's something in these things that is a kind of demiurge, in my judgment, that causes us to erect them not just because they have historical associations, which of course they do. And what I'm going to try and do is make a little sense out of this. Now, the first thing I think we ought to recognize is that these ideas do not die. Because people who study medieval architecture, among them our distinguished host, Professor Russell, tend naturally to look at Romanesque and Gothic buildings with their particular interest, as they should, sometimes we forget that classicism never really died. Here's about the capital from about the millennium in Aachen, of all places, that is to say, in what is now the western part of West Germany, as you know, and you will see that here the egg and the dart, which are one of those many repetitive motives of classicism, run across the top of our slide. You're looking at what I call a pilaster capital, that is a flat capital against a wall with not a freestanding column below it, where some unknown sculptor, perhaps around 1,000, give or take a little bit, had in front of him a model, some piece of ruinous ancient architecture from the Roman Empire, and tried to copy it. He copied it in a schematic way. Now, this says two or three things. One, there are always pieces around to look at. Research is well done on this. And second, that there was never a time, if this can stand for that, that these ideas of some way of making architecture that we call classicism went out of existence entirely. Here's a department store of 1928 in Springfield, Massachusetts, where the blood brother of that Aachen capital cast in concrete is made in what is called Art Deco style. That is to say, the fronts of those great movie theaters of 1928, 1940, and so on. If you look closely, you'll see a sunburst at the bottom. It's not a very good slide. And a zigzag coming down the middle of the upper part. These are hallmarks of the Art Deco style in much architectural as other kinds of design in the late 20s and the early 30s. But the capital itself has the turned elements at the corners and various other parts that are to the late 1920s what the Aachen capital of 1,000 years before were. Or to bring it up to date, it's hard to read, I know, but you're looking at a Corinthian capital, not structural, made into a fountain by the contemporary architect Charles Moore at the famous Piazza d'Italia in New Orleans in the 1960s. You can just make out the parts. The scrolls are up above. The leaves have of the acanthus weed have been stylized and made into geometric forms. But nevertheless, it is recognizably in classicism one of that enormous family of interpretations through the centuries of the classical idea. Now, most of us, quite rightly, I think, when we think of monumental classicism, think of the Parthenon in Athens, the front of the Pantheon in Rome, and in our own country, the older and newer buildings in this cool, calculated, not unbeautiful in some ways, massive monumental style that we know we owe in part at least to Thomas Jefferson and in part to adventurous architects who came here from England and some in this country. This is John Russell Pope's Archives Building in Washington, just off the Mall, as I'm sure you know, on Constitution Avenue, and it dates from, was finished in 1935. But it is the kind of thing that we tend to think of as the proper definition of classicism, in the sense at least of monumentality, associations with grand concepts, a religious concept, a governmental concept, as in this case, plus a historical concept. And in addition, the archives are a good example because of the fact that they are a repository concept. All these ideas, among others, inhere in classicism, and that's why it is so difficult for the historian of art and architecture to trace the complex genealogy of this problem. So to try and simplify it a bit, not because I would ever dream of talking down to you, but because I myself don't know the answers to these questions, and the exercise of simplifying helps me a great deal, let's look at the triangle up there at the top. Not the sculpture, which is typical government-inspired 1930s sculpture. It's really not very bad, and of course it's coming back now, studies and interest in it, whereas 30 years ago you couldn't get a student to work on a topic like that for anything, no matter what inducements were offered. And by the way, I've been trying to get students to work on John Russell Pope for a long time. Now I find, now that I'm out of the business, there are several gifted young people working on them. This triangle up there, the only stable geometric figure, the only one, that is, if you pin the three corners, as an engineer would say, you then can't move the triangle, the principle of so much work in trusses and the like. Do I make any sense? It is a truly stable figure. If you pin the corners of the square, it doesn't do you any good. You can move it around. And we sense this in our kinetic and receptive systems. Second, it is, of course, the end of a roof. It's nothing but a gable. And therefore, it has a primal architectural association. I would like to quote Picasso here. When he first saw the Parthenon in Athens, he is reputed to have said, Pablo, how do you like it? And he is reputed to have replied, oh, it's wonderful. He said, it's a great big barn with columns on it. I find this a very useful remark, because the principle of classicism, as we think of it in its monumental style, is like that. A walled room with columns all around her in part, with a half-open, half-closed thing we call a porch, the whole thing capped by this stable, great pediment. By the way, the Latin word for that is fastigium. It has sacred connotations, which shows how powerful the workings of this imagery have been. This is one in North Africa, in Tunisia, and I point out once again, as in the archives that you saw a moment ago, that this triangle up there is always powerfully drawn in. By that I mean, if your artist friend is sketching for you and draws a pediment, he uses heavy lines. Why? Because the moldings that frame it, two raking, one horizontal, always project out into the light. And this slide, I hope, makes that clear. The definition of this primary form with the columns, not quite cylindrical, they're more complex than that in terms of geometric form. These things taken together create an image, archives, Roman temple, etc., that we're going to see through this talk tonight, and which are, in much monumental classical architecture, the crowning thing, the end, the apex. In fact, we use the very same words the ancients did for the point at the top. This is a great church in Rome of the very turn of the 16th into the 17th century. Santa Susanna, up on the Quirinal Hill. You're looking at a telephoto view of a very elaborate piece of counter-reformation that is Baroque architecture. And it's not like ancient architecture in detail, but in principle it's the same. This comes down like an endless waterfall of generation of architectural forms right down to the present. And in order to make my first point, which is that it is a daily, everyday architecture, I want to show you that in antiquity, these ideas that begin in Greek architecture in the 8th and early 7th century BC, and are still with us, were very, very popular with ordinary, everyday people, as they are in many ways to this day. I wonder how many people in this room have pediments. Over the porch, over the windows, at the end of the house, if you're in a Greek Revival perhaps house or a derivative of that, or how many you go through in a day. Not I see on the Rhodes College campus, but in many that one visits. You're in Herculaneum, out in a garden of an ordinary everyday house. We're looking at work of probably AD 50, AD 60. You'll remember Herculaneum was destroyed in the same catastrophe as Vesuvius in AD 79. If I stand in that little semicircular bowl there, my head comes up another couple of feet. This will give you scales, very small. There is a niche back there, which you can just make out. And that niche has a painting of a shell on it, which if you look very carefully to the right-hand side of the curve under the pediment, you'll see it. There are two columns made of rough concrete, stuccoed over and painted, restored here to a degree. Above the whole thing is a pediment with fierce moldings, in the sense that they're muscular and strong. The artist is, excuse me, the builder's not interested in refinement. He wants to say pediment, capital P, E, and so forth. What it is, of course, is a slice, like the end of the loaf of bread, of a temple. So that it says out in this garden, and says it loudly and clearly, this is a religious, important place of tradition. Down below, there's a shelf. And on that shelf there would be placed some objects sanctified in the family. Perhaps a bust of an ancestor, more likely a little statuette of a household god or goddess of the kind you see in many museums. Now that's a very interesting thing. Here's this wall back there, which was also stuccoed and painted. You cannot walk through it, but they take, scoop part of the wall out, the niche. They make an arch up over it, which you can dimly make out, and a little sort of vault. They frame this whole thing with a temple. And they let you walk in, as it were, there to make some religious act or to stand contemplatively before the statue, as the case may be. It looks like the simplest thing in the world, but as we examine it, it's a very tough compound device. In my judgment, it speaks of protective presentation. Whatever is on that shelf that is important to the people who have this garden in this house is exhibited, displayed, and protected at all at the same time with a two-column temple front. And the pediment seals it. And also, of course, as you know, the pediment gives it symmetry and balance and stability. And this, as I say, is in an ordinary middle class, the phrase is not very good for antiquity, but an ordinary everyday middle income family in Herculaneum, which, as you know, was a fairly prosperous seaside town. So powerful is this image in daily life in antiquity that people living in this apartment house of the port city of Rome, ancient Ostia, O-S-T-I-A. By the way, if you've never been to Ostia and you go to Rome, please go down and see it. It's one of the great sights of the Mediterranean. It isn't visited as much as Pompeii and Herculaneum because you don't have all the sense of immediacy. But if you're interested in towns and their layout, and what things were like in the last great phase of pagan antiquity in terms of life, daily life, Ostia is wonderful. This is a modern doorway. This is an apartment house of brick-faced concrete, three stories high with apartments 2 to 5 rooms, absolutely standard Roman way of building in the 2nd century AD. And here, with that arch built of huge tiles, these tiles are 2 feet square that you see in the wall, the builder has sketched in broken tiles, a pediment. It doesn't keep the rain off anybody. It doesn't have any columns underneath it. But we're so used to this, the AT&T sphere, I just use that, you can think of hundreds of others. It is an ideogram. It is a powerfully suggestive force in architecture, and this example, I could show you many others, may stand for that. And it also may suggest to you how this little diagrammatic production of a pediment was as important to them as it was in the Herculaneum house, on the majestic great temples, the architects of Italy, United States, and many other countries later on. So it isn't just the top of a temple. Second, sometimes I think half the people in all antiquity did nothing but cut Corinthian capitals. There are tens of thousands of them. They are the routine, one's tempted to say stamped out, forms. Here is a depository in a great Near Eastern site in Jordan called Jericho, where the archaeologists, who were Americans when this work was done, the Jordanians are continuing there, got so many of these things they made, I always call these parking lots. They stack these things up, they get numbered and recorded. Nobody is very interested in them anymore, unfortunately. And I show this slide in order to show that it is not beauty or some kind of ennobling Greek thought that is often ascribed to this sort of thing that people are interested in, but they're normal, everyday surroundings. This is part of a big street colonnade, some of which has been re-erected in the back right-hand side of the slide. This is at the same site, and it's a fallen piece of entablature. That's that great big horizontal member that the columns support in almost all classical architecture. Maybe the bottom of a pediment, or it may go along by itself, etc. Now, this is lying on the ground and much enlarged on the screen, local stone. And I'd like to have you see that whoever cut this went along at high speed. They were not looking for art, capital A. They were not looking for beautifully organized and sculpted surfaces. They were looking for the staccato of light and shade, which they loved. They were looking for the thing that said entablature, even though it doesn't look anything like the great finished marble temples of the centers of power, Athens, Rome, Corinth, Ephesus, etc., but out in a caravan, successful desert caravan town. It's really three-dimensional stencil work. They cut it by the mile in some of these small towns, stuck it up on those columns, and that, in my judgment, really is true classicism. I'll show you more of it in a moment. But if you consider for a moment that the late Greco-Roman world was towns made up in this fashion, in what are now 31 modern countries, in a distance from the Straits of Gibraltar to Beirut, which is the same as New York to Denver, you get some sense of the spread of all this. There were 8,000 municipal entities in the Roman Empire, the scholars say, and we have about 800 sites where we have enough archaeological evidence to be reasonably sure we know what we're talking about. Let me show you one. I'm sorry about this slide. The film got put in the glove compartment, and you know what happens to film in glove compartments when it's hot. This is a site in Algeria, in the eastern part of it, not far from the great Muslim city of Constantine. The French archaeologists worked here between the two world wars. They restored the temple partly, put up a few columns, but you're looking at a market town of AD 100. It's called Jamila in Arabic, the beautiful. And here is a French Air Force officer's photograph of it from above. AD 100, Roman market town. On the left, on the right, excuse me, is a semi-grid, not a real grid, but a partial grid. The big square towards the right-hand side of the slide is the forum. The big street is broken at an angle, right-hand side of the slide, just above the forum. Then the wall of the old city goes right down through the bottom part of the slide at a diagonal. I'm not sure how far I can safely go.
This is the wall of the original city. You see the surveyor's way out to the right. It prospered and grew this way, south up the hill here, so to speak.
It grew without planning. We're all used to that, of course, in American towns. At the bottom left, a theater. At the top left, an enormous bath building, a social center. Down here, a Christian quarter with a baptistry, round roof put on by the French, and all the apparatus of small town life. Well, these are extraordinary places. First of all, there are dozens and dozens of them. I've had the great pleasure in my life of, over the years, crisscrossing this area, trying to see as much of the evidence as I can. And a talk like this rests in part upon the inspection of these sites. The letter A on the right is the forum. The heavy line is the outline of the original surveyed town. At the letter D, a new forum, or plaza, with a huge temple, the black spot. The theater is at E, the bath is at G, etc. 5,000, 10,000, 11,000 people, probably. It disappears from history in a list of bishops in Constantinople and a synod in the late 6th century. It went on after that, but we don't have any real record. Let's look at this town. It's the most extraordinary site. If you look down at the forum, which is the white part, center part of the screen, about top, and you look carefully, you'll see it's a kind of grid. That is to say, it's a surveyor. Surveyors came with their instruments, laid it out, laid the water on, and went home. The local farmers came here, Roman businessmen, people given citizenship in the later ancient world, and the place prospered. And you're looking at the pieces of houses in front of you here, and this street that curves down in front of you goes down to the theater. All these things were added later after the original town was outgrown. Here's the angle in that street that you saw in the aerial view in the sketch plan. On the right, colonnades. Why? Ah, we're a real town. We want to look like the big city. Some of you have been, of course, to Ephesus and Pergamon and places like that, and you know they had colonnaded streets. This is the sewer underneath this. There are shops on the left. The Forum is out of sight to the left. And look what happens at that 15-degree angle of the street. We used to think they put these arches miscellaneously. I'm convinced I know better now, if I may say such a thing. This arch is right at that angle, framing the view as it changes by the laws of parallax and tangency, and the whole place has a kind of satisfactory provincialism. When the new plaza was built, the original town is behind us, they put up a temple way outsized. This happens again and again. You know from your travels in France and Spain that many a small town will have a colossal church rising up from it, and this is similar. The French restored part of this. The street to the theater would go to the left, and there, of course, it doesn't have the pediment, it's gone, is that icon of Greco-Roman architecture, which says civilization, tradition, belonging, continuity. And these, I think, are some of the essential reasons for the durability of classicism. I love this fountain. The French found it almost intact. Water went up a pipe, had a good stand of water higher than this, good head of water. Water went up the pipe, came down. And look at where the ropes have worn away the limestone of the town as people drew water from this aqueduct-supplied fountain. There are 14 fountains at Jamila, and this is a little tiny, provincial, unimportant town from the point of view of the main centers. Then about AD 200, they got a bath building of extraordinary size. Great, big, monumental building. You saw it in the aerial photograph. You come in off the street down below. I just want you to see the weaving and movement of passage from hot bath, cold bath, massage rooms, latrine, locker rooms, swimming pools, and so on. These places sometimes had libraries, exercise grounds, and the like. Now, here we are in a little tiny town. In my upbringing in northern New England, this would be Keene, New Hampshire. I can't give a ready Tennessee town, even though I was stationed in Tennessee as a young soldier for quite a long time. Smyrna, Tennessee. There we are. We've got it. Though I noticed the other day in Smyrna that it's grown enormously since I was stationed there. And this little town gets another kind of demonstration of classicism. Now, you only have to look at this for a minute and see that there are almost no columns. If I tell you now these spaces are all vaulted over and of different heights, vaulted in concrete, you realize that, of course, this isn't classical at all in the sense of the front of the beautiful old church or, as I say, classical, traditional home of the United States and the like. This happens to be in another part of the empire entirely, but it's the interior of one of these buildings. This is in Trier. The dark lines below are plan. I just want you to see this kind of space making that everybody knew, because entry to these places was either free or cost a half a penny or whatever. And as you know, the hulks of them in Rome, there are five great hulks of them left in Rome to this day. When you go to the summer opera in Rome in the Basilica Caracalla, you're in one of these places. So this is a rather peculiar situation. At one point, there'll be the temple, or a variety of temples. Then there will be long colonnades. Then there will be these bath buildings, which are for everybody. And of course, theaters, amphitheaters, race courses, basilicas, that is to say law courts, markets, fountains, and the like. Daily, ordinary experience. Here's a very elaborate one out in Jordan, same place where we saw the piled up capitals. And I just quickly want to point out to the extraordinary, 17th century Italian evocation of this. Fountains left and right, one showing, lots of statuary, Roman honorific arch of the kind that appears everywhere in classicism in the back. Past that, there was a huge bridge going over a river. Main street of the town is right in front of you in the shadow down below. Far cry from the Parthenon, isn't it? Far cry from the scrupulously clear Greek temples of Sicily, southern Italy, Greece, and Asia Minor. This is a classicism of popular kind. If it hadn't succeeded, if it hadn't been popular, it surely wouldn't have succeeded. It's not all marble-cut, grand, and elevated by 18th and 19th century Europeans and Americans to romantic status. This is a very interesting problem in the history of art and architecture. The fight of the Greeks against the Turks for independence, the adventuresome Englishmen who went out and measured things before that in the 18th century, all created an ambience of saying that the Parthenon and its ilk were somehow, like Pindar, like the greatest works of Aeschylus and Sophocles, etc., were idealized and ennobled. They're wonderful things, but they do not represent classicism. If you're interested in buildings, look at this. This is a bath building out at Hadrian's Villa near Tivoli that a friend of mine and I excavated and published. You can hardly find a corridor in it. This man hated corridors. The immediacy of these shapes, it's a private bath building, but this is classicism too. It's concrete vaulted building also. In other words, the clear marble building, columned building is not necessarily the only kind of classicism at all. This Professor Michael Boyle's aerial view restored of that building, and you'll see you can't find a column anywhere. Though there surely were entablatures and pediments, we don't have the evidence, so we didn't put them in this drawing. And what you've got here, of course, is a very ingenious solution for rooms of different size, all of which have to be lit, different size and shape, put together in a kind of carpentry or joinery. I mention these things in order to be sure that we see what classicism can be. I won't dwell on this further except to say here's a cutaway showing the swimming pools, the facilities, and the like inside. Everybody in the last phase of Greco-Roman antiquity knew these buildings, large and small. They're the great success story, by the way, of Roman architecture. The baths, they're everywhere. Some English archaeologists quipped upon uncovering another Roman bath building in Britain. Oh, nobody's ever lived this comfortably here since. Now, ordinary everyday people, self-made men and women, not the very poor, study of economics in ancient times, very difficult subject, but people wanted elaborate tombs. Coming from the airport with Professor Russell this noon, we passed a beautiful cemetery, and there were the obelisks and the columns and the Roman altars out there in a Memphis cemetery doing what has been done in classicizing cemeteries, as, for example, the beautiful work at Bellefontaine in St. Louis, to just quote one American example. These drawings by a German scholar show the tombs of, sorry, they're not complete down here, tombs of less magnitude at the bottom, a very famous one in Provence on the right, a famous one in northern Italy, not so far from Venice on the left, and you will see that pediments, arches, columns, round structures, and the moldings, all the apparatus of classicism was used in cemeteries. Another drawing from this same German work, because I want you to see the drama and scenic effects in cemeteries. If you go back to Pompeii and walk outside the great gates, the Porta Nucera, the Herculaneum Gate, and so forth, you'll see these buildings partly restored, not the same ones, but of this type, along the cemeteries. Now, all of this, I think, is fair and correct. But something else happens in the durability of classicism that is fascinating. When the great humanist scholars, chiefly those in Italy, rediscovered classicism, particularly architecture, men like Alberti and Brunelleschi and others, they took the tools of classicism, column, pediment, molding, etc., and reused them, as we all know. And I'm not going to go into that subject because that's the best studied, best known single phase of classicism that, depending on your point of view, culminates at the beginning with Brunelleschi in Florence, or from my point of view with Michelangelo in his extraordinary inventions in St. Peter's, on the Capitol, and in some very little known buildings. There's a chapel in Santa Maria Maggiore, for example, in Rome, that are ingenious almost beyond a description, all from Michelangelo's hand. Isn't it wonderful that he said, "I am not an architect"? If you ever looked at the wall of St. Peter's, the most extraordinary thing. When the Counter-Reformation comes along, these familiar forms were in evidence everywhere. And after the Council of Trent, in the middle of the 16th century, classicism blooms once again in the Baroque style. I show you the great stately church of Santa Maria in Campitelli, and there's a reason for this, as will come along in a moment, to show you that the Counter-Reformation took on that drama of the of antiquity, though of course with differences, and this is the upper part of that facade. This church, by the way, is just below the Campidoglio to the north, on a little narrow, on a large narrow piazza. And here you see an inventive and a very great architect, in my judgment, Carlo Rainaldi, in the middle of the 17th century now, taking these parts, pediments, columns, all the rest of it, and reassembling them. And that is another fundamental point in this discussion. These parts, as you've already seen, can be combined and recombined in a seemingly endless set of permutations and combinations. Many people who study Greek architecture of Pericles' time, the great buildings of Athens, for example, do not care for some of these permutations and combinations because they seem impure, and one respects and understands that. But life doesn't stand still, and here is an example, and not to everybody's taste, perhaps, but an example of that flexibility of classicism, which is no respecter of time, of geography, curiously of technology. We've already seen buildings in different kinds of stone, of stucco, and of concrete, all of which come under the classical rubric, and if we had the time to deal with it, we could get into wood, plaster, cast iron, etc. Here's the front of another one of these churches, a little earlier, 1603, by Carlo Maderno, Santa Susanna. We saw the top of it in an earlier slide. And though this is not antiquity directly, it is, of course, familiar, a familiar of antiquity. It is consanguineous. It belongs to the ideas of antiquity. Marvelous, tight, symmetrical, balanced equipoise of forms, but that is the Counter-Reformation style. I'd like to call your attention to the center of the upper story. Perhaps you can just see, under the arch with the rays in it, a martyr's crown, Santa Susanna's crown in the center of it. And you'll notice that it is framed by a rectangle with an arch over it. Then above that, there are two columns and an entablature. Then a curved pediment, then two pilasters, then more, then a temple front all around that. About five or six separate enframements. And I'm convinced that people like this architect knew perfectly well, here's a detail of the central part of that, that knew perfectly well the ancient ruins in Rome, of course, in the environs, and studied them. We have drawings from their hands and so forth. And they could also see things we couldn't see. And I'd like to contrast this to show these continuities and durabilities with a Roman monument. You have to think in the columns. They've gone now. They would rest on these projecting elements down here, and the capitals would be up there. But do look at the similarities. Pilaster, square element, shell, curve. Then way out here, there are more pilasters. You can see it better on the right-hand side of the screen. You have to learn to read these ruinous things. They're excellent restorations, and a very sort of baroque pediment chewed into up at the top, which Italian masters of the 17th century like. Now, this is purely an accident. I don't say for a moment that these are connected in fact, that is, that the later architect copied something earlier. It is the sympathy of the kind of expression. The rhetorical content is much the same in artistic terms. The ideological content is very different. One is a church, one is a pagan entranceway to a Roman temple. Here's the inside of Rinaldi's building. This is 1663. And you are looking down the nave, very complicated building, at an icon which is in the center of that burst, sunburst. It isn't a good picture, I realize that. All I want to point out here is that by 1650, the center of the Catholic persuasion was making these grand scenic monuments, which probably owe more to antiquity than has often been said. And if those of my age, more or less, in the audience, remember those movie theaters we used to go to, you see here something of that popular drama. For what could be a more popular intent than to bring the congregation in, whatever one's personal religious convictions are, bring the congregation in, the people of the quarter, to worship in these surroundings. It